Okay, good morning, everyone. So good to see you again. The plan for today is to step back a little bit from what we've been doing so far. Most of our shiurim so far have been specific halakha topics, specific questions that have come up, and the way that different poskim try to address them. What we're going to be doing today is focusing a little bit more broadly on, I guess, the methodology. Maybe is the right term for how poskim approach these questions through the lens of two presentations of Rav Schechter, where he explains why he feels comfortable overriding various minhagim during COVID. This is part of a general shift that's been happening for me as we go through these topics, and have been noticing certain trends in our poskim in the way that they write and present their halakhic rulings. I've been thinking a little bit more broadly about wider themes, I suppose, in their writing and thinking and psak. And so hopefully at some point we'll spend a little bit more time reflecting on some of those themes. That's the plan for one of our Sundays, you know, coming up. But for now, we're just going to look at a couple of explicit treatments of a relatively local issue, which is the issue of how to relate to minhagim during the period of COVID. Rav Schechter wrote two tshuvot on this topic. I actually first noticed this topic. I was looking through some of Rav Schechter's writings, and I saw that he had two tshuvot on Wayu Torah with very similar titles. One was called Minhagim in Difficult Times, I believe, and the other was called Keeping Minhagim in Challenging Times, or something along those lines. Seeing that repetition, I wanted to figure out why there were two of them, what he was trying to get at, and I think reading both of those tshuvot in dialogue with one another is going to be pretty interesting. So I'm going to start sharing my screen now. The plan is to read those two tshuvot, and when relevant, to look at a couple of the background sources that he quotes to justify his positions and how he comes to the rulings that he does. So I'm now sharing my screen, and we'll start with the first tshuva, tshuva number four, which is called Minhagi Hatzibur Bishat Hadchak, the customs of the community in difficult circumstances, I suppose, as opposed to the later one, which we'll see shortly, which doesn't have a title that relates directly to Minhag, but ends up dealing with very similar themes. Because we're going to be mostly focusing on these tshuva as texts in and of themselves, we're going to focus more on the Hebrew, but I'll translate as we go and we'll fill in the picture as it becomes more relevant. So Rav Schechter begins. Meshach kol hadorot, nahagu b'kama b'chama midot chasidut, b'shum chumra d'chametz. Over the course of many generations, we've adopted many additional stringencies or meritorious customs surrounding chametz on Pesach. Anyone who's ever cleaned their kitchen for Pesach knows that we certainly have adopted a great many stringencies when it comes to Pesach in terms of how thoroughly we clean and how rigorously we prepare ourselves for Hilchot Pesach. And there are other chumras he's referring to as well that we'll see as we go. Already from the starting line, we could see the context that Rav Schechter was talking about. This is one of the earlier tshuvot that he had published. And this is around Pesach time, meaning the lockdowns were pretty new. They were also relatively extreme. People were really isolated and on their own for Pesach. And a lot of difficult questions were coming up at this time surrounding how to keep Pesach in an optimal manner when one doesn't have access to the things that we'll normally have access to during Pesach. So that's where he's situating himself. And he notes, our communities have adopted a great many important chumrot when it comes to Pesach. Among them, ledakdek le'achol rak matzot shmura kol ha-Pesach v'chayotzeba. One of those chumrot, for example, is to only eat shmura matzah, only eat matzah that has been watched already from the time of being harvested, which isn't necessary in order for the matzah to be kosher, but is a chumrot that people have adopted sort of above and beyond the baseline halacha of at what point you need to start watching your matzahs. So shmura matzahs need to be watched from a far earlier time, and we're usually makbet to eat those on Leil HaSeder, but many are makbet to eat them for all of Pesach. That's just one chumrah, but there are many in terms of how rigorously we clean for Pesach, the kind of things we allow ourselves to eat on Pesach, and so on. And lest we think that these are just nice minhagim that we do, Rav Zaksh was quick to note that he thinks that they're halachically binding. The hashita mikubelet b'shulchan aruch, he kedat balei hatosvot. The accepted position of the shulchan aruch is like the shita of the Tosafists, a certain set of rishonim. Shem minhag tov mechayev vidarabanan mita'am neder. Any good minhag that a person has is not only a good minhag, but it's actually authoritative, it's binding on a derabanan level. Mita'am neder. In the same way that if one takes a neder, one makes an oath to keep a certain halacha or to practice in a certain way, that would be binding, and that one would need certain kinds of exemptions in order to override that halacha. So too with any good minhag that one follows. So at this point, we'll switch and see just that passage of the Shulchan Aruch, which will flesh out a few of the details of what Rav Zaksh is alluding to. The Shulchan Aruch has this one siman called La'avor al minhag tzarech hatara. If one wants to violate a minhag that one has previously practiced, one needs what's called a hatara nedarim. Conventionally, people have the custom to do this on Erev or Hashanah or around the time of the Yemim Nora'im, to go to a Beit Din or a makeshift Beit Din and request sort of exemptions from our nedarim, which it is possible to go to a Beit Din and do. And apparently, one thing that one would need to go to a Beit Din and ask for hatara for are these minhagim, right? Bringing a minhag requires a hatara according to the Shulchan Aruch. And the Shulchan Aruch describes that in a little bit more detail as follows. Dvarim ha-mutarim, things that are mutar, v'hayotim behem shehim mutarim nagu behem iser, but nonetheless, people who know that they're mutar decide not to do them anyway. Havei ki'ilu kiblo alehem v'neder, v'asur la'atiram lehem. Those are binding as a neder, and you can't just allow people to do them whenever you want. And if you want to, and the Shulchan Aruch is going to explain, you're going to need a proper hatara nedarim, which is the process by which we can sort of nullify oaths and permit them to ourselves. And the Shulchan Aruch gives a few examples. Hilkach, misha ragil li'itanot ta'aniot lefnei, shalefnei Rosh Hashanah, v'shebein Rosh Hashanah li'yom ha-kipurim. If one has the practice of fasting either before Rosh Hashanah or during the Aseret Yemei Tshuva, there were various practices in the Middle Ages about fasting during those times, which aren't obligatory, but were sort of positive customs that existed. Or misha ragil shalo lechol basar v'shalo l'shot yayin mirosh chodesh av omayud zayin b'tamuz. Or if one is the minhag of not eating meat during the 9 days or during the 3 weeks before Tisha B'Av, which the Shulchan Aruch thinks might not be obligatory until the week of Tisha B'Av itself. V'rotza lachzor bo machma she'eino bari, and if you want to break that minhag because you're not feeling, you know, particularly healthy, you'd like to eat meat during those times, well, breaking a minhag is the same thing as breaking a vow. And if you want to break a vow, you need to get a hatara nedarim. Sarach gimel sheyatiru lo. You need a beit din to, you know, nullify the vow so that you're allowed to break these minhagim and go back to your sort of normal practice. We'll skip the next line, sort of doubles down on this point, and suggests that if you intend to accept it as a sort of binding practice on yourself, you don't need to practice it multiple times. You only
Alex once.
Have. Ready
in a car.
Yes, lefichach harotza lenog bo b'ksat dvarim hamutarim. If you want to, in certain things that are mutter, practice for yourself, l'sgag uprishut, you have to take some chumra upon yourself. If you want to do so, yomar b'tchilat hanagato she'enu mekabel alav kin b'neder. You should explicitly say when you're taking on certain practices that are not halakhically binding, this is not a neder. B'li neder, I'm going to do this practice. So for example, I know those who have the practice to stand during Torah reading in shul. And when they do so, they're particular to have in mind, sometimes even to articulate out loud, that this practice is not a neder. They're not accepting it as a binding halacha. If they ever are feeling tired and would like to switch to sitting during Kriyat Torah, they'd be allowed to do so because they didn't accept it as a neder. But without making that explicit stipulation that you're not accepting it as a binding neder, the Shulchan Aruch assumes that you're required to keep it as a binding oath. Let's skip a couple of lines. All right, then the Shulchan Aruch quotes a brief dispute about what happens if a person mistakenly thinks something is actually usur. Let's say you think that you're actually obligated to stand her and create a Torah. You don't know that it's not an obligation, that it's only a nice minhag. And so you stand during Torah reading because you feel like you have to. And then you learn, oh, it's not actually obligatory. Do you then require Atarat Nedarim? Zohar, of course, two opinions about that point. And then the Ramah concludes that the proper practice is that you do not need Atarat Nedarim. Meaning, if you accept this practice without knowing that it's fundamentally voluntary and you're accepting it only as an extra religiously motivated practice, then you don't need Atarat Nedarim. We don't assume that you had in mind to accept it as though it were a neder. So that all relates to private practice in this first se'if of the Shulchan Aruch. The second se'if relates more broadly to public practice. And that's the kind of minhag that's going to be more difficult to overrule. Kabbalat harabim chala aleihem va'al zaram. If the community, if the rabim, the populace of the Jewish people, accept a certain practice upon themselves, then it's binding not only on the people individually who accepted it, but also on their descendants. These minhagim have staying power over the course of multiple generations. Va'afilu bidvarim, shalo kiblu aleihem b'nei ha'ir b'haskama. Even if the people in the city didn't sit down and vote on it or have some kind of formal binding process in which we accept this ruling, ela shenoegim kein mi'asma, la'asot geder usyag la'Torah, but they rather just practiced it on their own as a fence to the Torah, as a protection to the Torah, then those are considered binding. And not only are the members of that community, which had originally accepted this practice, bound to that practice over the course of generations, v'chein haba'im mechus la'ir ladur sham. If you move to that city to live there, hareihem ka'anshei ha'ir v'chayavim la'asot kitakanatan. Then they are as the members of the city. They are bound by the same practices that the city had accepted. So if there's a minhag that the city of Chicago or the city of Amsterdam or the city of Dubai or any city with a Jewish population had accepted upon themselves, then moving to that city obligates you in those practices. And there are a number of areas where this might be relevant. Primarily we can imagine practices that take place at shul, for example. If this is the minhag of our kihila, of our community at shul, then that becomes binding on members who move to that community, who join that shul. That's one area nowadays where community-bound minhagim are located. And so those minhagim are considered themselves binding. Excuse me. And so we have this notion in the Shulchan Aruch that Rav Shaffer appeals to, that minhag can be considered not only a nice practice that is performed, but also halachically binding. And that there needs to be some process by which we permit those minhagim if we need to, and you can't just drop them willy-nilly. So just returning to Rav Shaffer's tshuva now, he alludes to this notion of a personal minhag, also this notion of a public minhag. Because just like there are notions of individual oaths and public oaths, there are also notions, there are personal minhagim, and there are communal or public minhagim. And each person, he says, is bound to the minhag of his community. And starting from that perspective, any COVID-related issue where we might want to drop a minhag for the purpose of making our lives a little bit easier during COVID or accommodating for the new reality during COVID is going to require minimally a process of Atarat Nedarim. One would need to go to a Beit Din of three men and, request that the vow be nullified, and the Beit Din would have to issue that allowance. Rav Shechter, however, appeals to a precedent that he thinks mostly nullifies this issue. And this is a really important precedent he appeals to in the next tshuva as well. Achein ayin sham bedagol meravava. Bedagol meravava is the same as the note of the Yehuda of Yecheska Landau, who's a very significant posek from the period of the Achronim, who makes the following claim. And we'll actually see it inside in a moment. She'im ira shat hadchak chad pa'anit. If a one-time complication or difficult circumstance comes up, that makes it impossible in this moment to keep the minhag, and you want to, drop the minhag for this purpose. Ve'eno wrote the lasorbo mikol v'kol me'anagato. But you don't want to totally drop the minhag forever. You just want to drop it once when it becomes relevant to do so. Then move on me'elav. Shekol zeh hayakalul b'nedro milechatchila. When you originally accepted your quote-unquote neder, when you accepted this minhag upon yourself as a practice that you're going to keep and lend authoritative significance to, it was assumed when you did so that you don't mean for the netter to be binding always and forever in every circumstance, even when it becomes impossible to perform. And so these kinds of extreme circumstances are built into the practice of the minhag, and whenever such a circumstance comes up, you're allowed to not follow the minhag without going through this formal process of hatarat nedarim. The logic he articulates a little bit more fully as follows. Dibin nedarim halach achar lashon b'nei adam v'achar kavanat hanoder. In halachot of nedarim, in oaths, these kinds of personal practices that we accept upon ourselves as binding, the way that we determine the scope of an oath has to do with what the person who made the oath had in mind. And the person who made an oath or practiced a minhag as authoritative, just like an oath, would never have had in mind that it would be binding even in these kinds of extreme circumstances. If anyone learns Masechta Nedarim in the Gemara, you'll find that much of the Masechta has to do with defining what a person who made an oath meant by certain words or in certain contexts. And that's based on the same notion, that a neder is fundamentally binding based on your intent and your articulation at the time that you make the neder. And so, argues Rav Shechter, in the time of extreme circumstances like the COVID pandemic or like the lockdowns from the COVID pandemic, these menhagim that we might have might not be binding. Umehai taima, excuse me, nahugu b'chol ha-makomot, shebishnat batsoret, shelo haya masbig matzah le'achol. All places had the practice that when there's an extreme famine, let's say, and there isn't enough food to eat on Pesach, hayu hagdolim mitkabzim yachad lahatir kitniot. Many great rabbis would get together and they would allow you to eat kitniot on Pesach, even though the Ashkenazi practice is not to eat kitniot on Pesach, because of the extreme circumstances they allowed themselves to. Duhu gamkin rak mita'am minhag, because eating kitniot on Pesach is only prohibited on the level of minhag, it is only a proper practice, and proper practices are binding generally, according to Rav Shechter and according to the Shulchan Aruch, but in extreme circumstances, they're not. Umuvan ha-davar me'elav, shebishat ha-dchak, lo haya b'dar ha-kihilot milechadchila linhog b'eser. When communities accepted the prohibition of kitniot upon themselves, they never had in mind that it would apply during a famine, of course not. And Rav Shechter just mentioned that they would have a community gathering and the rabbis would allow kitniot during years of famine. But that isn't a formally necessary. He just argues that v'hid kabtun harabanim, when the rabbis get together, hayarak b'chdei l'chboa shaya be'emet shatadchak. The rabbis only got together to determine on a factual level whether it is actually a severe enough circumstance to allow it. But the rabbis don't formally remove the prohibition. This isn't a meeting where they take a vote and decide kitniot is no longer binding. There's having a meeting to determine what is the reality on the ground. Is it severe enough that kitniot is no longer applicable in and of itself, or is it not? But fundamentally, Rav Shechter argues, minhagim are binding, and at the same time, they're not binding in extreme circumstances where it would be too difficult to fulfill them. Notably, Rav Shechter doesn't define what circumstances count as too extreme. He notes that in times of famine, rabbis would get together to debate these circumstances and make the determination, seemingly on a year-by-year basis, when it's particularly extreme and we need to allow kitniot, the rabbis would do so. And when it's not particularly extreme, they would not do so. And we noticed that probably a similar thing was happening during the early stages of the COVID pandemic, where rabbinic groups were getting together, assessing the reality and making determinations. Are we going to close shul? How are we going to handle issues of kashrus? How will we conduct davening when it becomes safe to do so? And these were determinations based on an assessment of the reality on the ground, what are the facts and what becomes permissible and what is no longer permissible. So that's Rishakhtar's core methodological claim that actually motivates a great many of his rulings over the course of the COVID pandemic. So for example, when talking about various menhagim about Pesach, or various menhagim in the way we conduct our tefillah, Rishakhtar is comfortable saying that those menhagim are not binding in the face of the Shat HaDchak, because he follows the position of the Notabi Yehuda in the Degel Merbava, that when you have an individual deviation from minhag motivated by extreme circumstances, you don't need any formal process to allow it, it just becomes permissible in and of itself. Okay, we'll skip the next paragraph, which is just another example of this. And we'll conclude with the final paragraph of this tshuva before we move to the next one. In this paragraph, he actually just cites one more precedent. We'll actually skip the paragraph and just look at the precedent in and of itself, because it's interesting to see it inside. Skipping the Dagla Ravava, which makes the claim that we saw in Rav Shechter a little bit earlier. There's a well-known halacha in the Shulchan Aruch that after eating meat, one should wait 6 hours before eating milk. This is a relatively well-known halacha. Achal basar, afilu shel chayav ov. If you eat meat or even chicken, which is not as, I guess, stringent as meat when it comes to the rules of eating meat and milk or cooking meat and milk in halacha. When you eat those foods, chicken or meat, lo yochal gvina acharav ad sheyesh sheshav. You should not eat cheese afterwards until you've waited 6 hours. And that's the position of the Shulchan Aruch, also the position of the Rambam. The Ramah does note that there are other minhagim. Those who have the practice of waiting only 1 hour after meat and milk. This is what is conventionally known as the Dutch minhag, but actually has a reasonable amount of support in the period of the Rishonim, especially Ashkenazi Rishonim. But the Ramah concludes, nonetheless, yesh medaktikin lahamtin sheshaot achar achilat basar legvina. Even though there are many who have the minha, who assume that the halacha, is that one should only wait 1 hour after eating meat before having dairy products. There are many who are makbed to wait longer. V'chein nachon la'asot, and that is appropriate to do. So it ends up that waiting 6 hours, according to the Ramah, is the proper practice, and one ought to do so, even if it's not necessarily the baseline halacha. Which means that it probably follows into what our chapter calls this category of minhag. According to those who believe that the baseline halacha is that you need not wait 6 hours, that you might be able to wait only 1 hour, or even just wait till the end of the meal, without getting too deep into the details of the sugya, waiting 6 hours becomes a minhag that should be binding in the same way Rav Shechter thinks all minhagim are binding. Generally binding midarabanan, but not in extreme circumstances. And he quotes precedent for this from the Pitchei Tshuva, quoting the Chatam Sofer, who rules the following. A sick person who drinks meme chalav, a certain kind of dairy product. It's not dairy itself, it's some kind of product that derives from milk. For the purposes of refuah, some medicinal value. Afilu hu rak chole ktzat, even if you're really only, very minorly sick, you're not particularly ill, it's not very extreme, but nonetheless, it's a minor illness that you have. You don't need to accept the practice of waiting 6 hours after meat to have this dairy product that you're drinking for medicinal purposes, because minhagim are binding, but again, only in non-extreme circumstances. And even apparently a minor illness, according to Rav Shechter, meets that threshold of sufficiently in-extreme circumstances. So in our tshuva, Rav Shechter has made two core points. Minhagim are binding, minhagim are very significant. But nonetheless, they're easy to override in extreme circumstances. And this becomes a core methodological tool that he has in his toolkit whenever an issue of minhag comes against the needs of COVID. The needs of COVID can often relatively easily trump. And Rav Shechter articulates that as a general principle here. He doesn't apply it to a particular halacha with regard to Pesach. He seems to articulate it as a sort of general rule. So, for example, in the paragraph we skipped, he refers to gebrachts, right? This minhag not to eat matzah that has come in contact with liquid. He seems to think that would easily fall under the category, but he also refers to other kinds of halachot and pesach that are binding as minhagim. Just the first tshuva, where he articulates his general principle. I want to take a second to look at the second tshuva. We're not going to read the whole thing because it's a little bit longer than the first one, but there are a couple of important lines or principles that I think are worth extracting from it. But before I do, I want to know if anyone has any questions on what we've seen so far together.
Rabbi, I have a question.
Please.
If I'm traveling to a city during Pesach that allows kitniot because of some circumstances, then I'm permitted to have the kitniot then.
So it, Great question. Based on what we've seen in the Shulchan Aruch, that should be the case, right? If not eating kitniot is a practice based on minhag, and the Shulchan Aruch seems to assume that minhag is fundamentally grounded in geography, right? When you move to a city, that city's minhag becomes binding on you. Then it seems that if you move to a community, let's say many Sephardi communities, where the minhag is to eat kitniot, that that might be permissible. Now, the complication is there are various ways to define the community that one is a part of and what practices are binding in those communities. So, for example, we could talk about the minhag of your immediate geographical area, your shul, let's say, or your, you know, community of Fairlawn. We could talk about minhag that's a little bit broader, the minhag of America. We could also talk about minhag that's no longer bound by geography. That might be bound by your sort of community of psak, so to speak, right? Jews often identify these days as Ashkenazi Jews or Sephardi Jews. So it might be that a Jew that is, in his identity, Sephardi, and identifies with the Sephardi community of halachic tradition, might be allowed to eat kitniot even if they're living in a geographically Ashkenazi place. So there are, you know, further complications, and this is an area that I think is sufficiently, I don't want to say controversial, but sufficiently hot that I recommend referring to one's local Orthodox rabbi for particular guidance. I will say that I have known people who, when they, let's say, moved from America to Israel, where in Israel, both eating kitniot is more common than it is in American communities, and the availability of non-kitniot kosher for Pesach food is lesser, that many people have changed their minhag as they move to Israel. Again, I recommend asking a specific shayla when it becomes relevant. I'm always happy to talk about kitniot and Pesach, though. It is a favorite topic of mine. Okay, any other observations or thoughts? Okay, so let's move now to this second tshuva, which is a little bit more recent from Rav Schechter, where his presentation, I think, differs slightly, makes the same overall point, but with a sort of different emphasis in this context. We're going to skip the first paragraph where he basically, or part of the first paragraph where he articulates what we've seen already, this idea that minhag is binding. He notes that not every Rishon agrees with this presentation of minhag being binding at, or as binding as a neder, neder abana, as binding as an oath. He notes, of course, as we've seen already, that there are both, you know, personal menhagim and communal menhagim, and he thinks that both of those are binding as well. Then he points to a very interesting passage from the Maharil, which is a collection of halachot and menhagim from Ashkenaz. We'll actually see it inside because I find it interesting. Then we'll see how Rav Schechter deals with it. The Maharil writes as follows. Amar Maharvi Segel, Mahari Segel says, Ein l'shanod minhag ha-makom, b'shum inyan, afilu b'nigunim, she'ein morgalim sham. A person should never change the minhag of a community, even with regard to the nigunim, even with regard to the tunes that are used during davening. If communities have well-defined tunes that they use, you shouldn't try using different tunes. That would constitute a breach of minhag. Then he tells the story about a time he was in Akila in Regensburg. These are a couple of European communities. I'm not particularly well-versed in medieval European Jewish geography, so I wish I could say more about them. But there was a time when he, Mari Segel, was a shliach tzibur in one of these communities, and he practiced the minhag of those communities. He followed the minhag in the tunes for davening. He continues as follows. V'amar sheba oto pam hayhu omer slicha ani hamidaber asher yasad Rabino Ephraim lomar l'tfilat masaf. When he was davening there, he added this slicha, this, you know, extra poem or piyut, into the davening of masaf. And he thought you should say it. V'savar shemitzvah lomar sham l'chvod Rabino Ephraim hamachaber Asher Menuchat Kvodo Sham. Rabbeinu Ephraim, who had written this kina, had been buried in this community, and he thought it would be appropriate to read this kina, or this slicha, I'm sorry, as part of his davening. But the leaders of the community didn't like this minhag, because it violated their actual practice, which was not to recite this prayer on Yom Kippur. Liyamim concludes the Baharil, Meta Bat Harav B'Yom Kippur. The Rav's daughter died on Yom Kippur. The Hitzik Harav Niskar Alav Hadin Shalakta Bito Al Mashashina Menagamakam. And he argued that his daughter had died as a punishment for his having changed the minhag of tefillah. Now, theologically and religiously, there's a lot going on here about the notion of reward and punishment, or punishing family members for the sins of others, that would unfortunately be far beyond our scope today. It is, I think, worth noting that it's a pretty strong notion that one's family members can be punished for one's own misdeeds. It has a complicated history in Jewish text. The other thing that's worth noting is that he thinks, the Maharil thinks, that changing up the minhag tefillah in this community was severe enough to warrant this punishment. So that's what sets a very high bar on what the significance of keeping minhagim and the violation involved in not keeping minhagim. And Rav Shachter quotes this passage of the Maharil and offers an explanation for why it might, you know, I guess, how to make sense of it philosophically. He argues, V'ulai kavana tova zeh, she'im enenu mamshich b'menhaget hadorot hakudmim. If one doesn't accept the minhagim of previous generations, and this idea of accepting a Masorah from previous generations, im kein eno kedai litein lo yeladim, ki lo yehi kan shum hemsheich hadorot lahaba. If you don't accept your Masorah from the past, you won't be zocha to be able to pass on a Masorah to the future. So citing this Maharil sets a very high standard for the significance of minhagim in Rav Shachter's thought, right? As opposed to the first tshuva of Rav Shachter, where he knows minhag's a thing, it is binding, midar abanan like a neder. Here, I think that significance of minhag is set to a much higher standard, that is almost essential to what it means to be Jewish. The paragraph that we skipped sets up this notion that the idea of mitzvot in general is based on the Kedushat Yisrael that derives from our Masorah as well. Hamachayev v'kayim mitzvot, hu Kedushat Yisrael shel ha'adam. The reason that one is bound in keeping mitzvot is the inherent holiness that Jews possess. And Kedushat Yisrael, this holiness, ba'al lanu me'avotenu, v'gam yizeh she'anu gam kin ma'aminim bo yivar. Our Kedushat comes both from the fact that we believe in God and are engaged in a brit with God, but also as something that has been passed down from parent to child. It's inherent in this notion of Masorah. So the standard of minhag presented in this presentation, I think, is a much higher view of minhagim than we saw Rav Shachter present earlier. He also quotes the Rav in this paragraph as being makbid on minhagim, even minhagim that existed and then are reported to no longer exist. The Rav was still makbid, in many cases, on adopting those minhagim and practicing those minhagim. So minhag is very significant in this presentation. And after that sort of development of the principle of minhag and the significance of minhag is very essential to what it means to be Jewish and what it means to be a halachic community that keeps mitzvot and engages with God. After all of that, Rav Shachter continues to say, "Uvamakom sheish stira ben denu minhag, pshita she'ein linhog b'minhag." Whenever there's a contradiction between a halacha and a minhag, of course you should follow the halacha. Of course you should not follow the minhag, right? So just to set his set of priorities, minhag has incredible, huge monumental significance. Also, anytime a mitzvah violates a minhag, you follow the mitzvah against the minhag. And that becomes the thrust of the rest of his tshuva. So to skip a little bit further to, to his application to COVID, so he states the following. There's a minhag that Rabbi Akiva Eger quotes that during the time of the very significant pandemic, at the time he's referring to cholera, but we might say the same thing about our experience, a very significant pandemic. Hora Rabbi Akiva Eger, And now finally we see what Rav Shach was talking about. He hadn't told us what he was talking about at the beginning of this tshuva. Finally we see what he's discussing. Rabbi Akiva Eger said that on Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, we should drop all of the piyutim from davening because they would extend davening and increase exposure to each other during the cholera epidemics. And despite the huge significance that he thinks that these piyutim have, nonetheless, they should be overridden for the sake of the mitzvah of keeping ourselves healthy. To minimize the time that the tzibur is exposed to one another. And, per his previous tshuva, you wouldn't need a tarah nedarim to allow it, based on the Nerabi Yehuda that we had seen, because the shadad chak and this idea of pikuach nefesh would override this principle. Pikuach nefesh, docha kol ha-tarah kula. Pikuach nefesh, saving lives or maintaining lives, overrides everything in Torah. Vin tzarech la-tarah nedarim. And so, of course, you don't need a tarah nedarim to allow it. He says further precedent for this idea from this practice of Rav Chaim Soloveitchik, which is also the practice of the community of Volozhin in Europe, which was to be relatively makil in many halachot of feeding sick people on Yom Kippur. And these kula that are cited in many places, and we'll skip the precise citation, are justified by the following line. When Rav Chaim Soloveitchik was asked, aren't you being makil on Hilchot Yom Kippur when you allow these various kinds of eating that would, you know, even though they're not not necessarily as severe, similarly by Shabbos, he also adopted, you know, many kulas. He responded, no. Chalila, I'm not being makil on pikuach, on Shabbos or on Yom Kippur. Ela shahaya machmir b'hilchot pikuach nefesh. I'm just being machmir in another set of halachot. I'm being machmir in the halachot of preserving people's health and preserving people's lives. And this justified many kulot for him in the realm of halachot of eating on Yom Kippur or doing malacha on Yom Kippur or on Shabbos. Were all justified not as kulot, but as chumrot. And that framing is a particularly important framing for Soloveitchik, also for Rav Shechter. This idea that we're going to be makil in Shabbos because we're being machmir in another set of halachot. That are equally important, if not more important. And so, based on all of this precedent, va'aleinu litzod ulin hog be'ikvot rabotinu Rabbi Akiva Eger, Rav Chaim Mivolozhin, v'hagon Rav Chaim Soloveitchik ode, we should follow these great leaders, Rabbi Akiva Eger, who allowed cutting out all of the piyutim on Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, as well as Rav Chaim and the sort of Masorah of Volozhin and of Brisk, to be making on many of these halachot. And this justifies for Rav Shechter cutting out piyutim on Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, as well as any other minhag that we have during davening that would extend davening and potentially endanger people's lives. This tshuva, I think, is a step beyond his previous one, so I understand why he adds it beyond the first one. Right? The first one articulates this sort of general principle. Of course, halachot b'shat hetchak are going to override minhagim, but here the standard is set much higher. The stakes of minhag are recognized. I understand that minhag is very significant. And at the same time, the stakes of health are also emphasized. It's not a regular shatat chak that might, you know, come up. This is the shatat chak of pikuach nefesh, halachot that we ought to be incredibly machmir on, based on the precedent of a great many authorities. This tshuva, I'll also note, came out on Tet Vav Elul, Tafshin Pei. So halfway through Elul, a couple of weeks before Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, where the discussion that Poskim and Rabbanim were dealing with is, how are we going to conduct davening on Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur? What are we going to do? Are we going to have normal, you know, length of davening? Are we going to cut it to the bare halachic minimum? Will we be including some piyutim or not? And Rav Shechter argues and takes this tack that if there is danger involved, we have to cut out, you know, everything but the bare minimum. If there's real danger involved, then Rav Shechter would tell us we have to cut out everything and just daven individually. But even if we're going to daven together, Rav Shechter was of the position to minimize the amount of davening, even though piyutim mean a great deal to people, and even though, as Rav Shechter argues, minhagim are fundamental and essential to what Judaism and halakhic life is about. So I'll stop sharing now and just briefly summarize what we've seen. We looked at two presentations of Rav Shechter that are a little bit more general than what we've seen to date, where he's arguing less about particular halakhic issues and more about broad halakhic principles. What is the place of minhag and of various communal practices in the halakhic calculus? And Rav Schachter at various points argues that minhagim are binding on a halakhic level in the first tshuva, or in the second tshuva that we saw, are fundamental and essential to what Judaism is about, and passing on a mesorah includes necessarily various minhagim. And at the same time, he argues in both places, with different degrees of severity, that minhagim ought to be overridden when there's a need to do so. So in the first tshuva, I'm thinking in a more toned-down sense, and then in the second tshuva, in a stronger and more forceful articulation. I think potentially because when it came to the minhagim of davening on Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, those minhagim are more significant for people, and so if we're going to override them, we want to acknowledge how significant they feel and how significant they are, and at the same time argue how important it is to override them. It may also be motivated just by the loosening of standards that had taken place over the 6 months between Pesach and Rosh Hashanah. During the time of Pesach, I think people were very, very particular about their health and about conducting davening in a way that is safe and responsible. And so the argument for how to conduct ourselves vis-a-vis minhagim didn't need to be made as forcefully. But as time went on, standards were a little bit laxer. We got used to davening together in person. And so it became important to re-emphasize these core principles in a stronger and more forceful way. I particularly appreciated this sort of broader, more general view, and we may be coming back to some of these broader themes in COVID halacha in future shiurim that we'll have together. I think we may come back next time to a more specific topic, but we'll make that decision for the coming week. I'm going to stop the recording now, but I'll stay for any questions or thoughts.